what you want, tell me what you see, where you wanna go, what you wanna be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of prayer. If you take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice. Wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice. Someone's gone before, maybe talk to them. Then after you do, go and talk to him. Great, it's gonna come, maybe not tonight. Take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends. Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz. But you moving kinda fast. Keep sweating, you gotta make it last. Live every day like it's your last. But don't forget to have a blast.
Welcome, welcome. This is Time Out with Sylvia Crawley. I am your host. We have a very interesting show for you today. But before we get started, I do have a couple of things I wanted to announce. My magazine, Monarch, is still doing our Women's Empowerment series on Thursdays on Twitter. Our staff is actually interviewing me this Thursday on a live Twitter chat. I can't believe I agreed to do this. But you can follow at Monarch Magazine. That's our that's Monarch's Twitter name. Or you could also follow the chat live on my Twitter page, which is S. Crawley Milbury. So that's a live Twitter chat this Thursday. We are still celebrating Father's Day. And there are some really good fathers out there who are great parents to their children. I got a chance yesterday to reach out to my father and wish him happy Father's Day. And I got a chance to talk to a lot of different fathers as I was, you know, kind of wishing them happy Father's Day. And what I gather is that it seems like there's a generation of fathers who weren't quite satisfied with their relationship with their father, and it's driving them to how they're parenting their kids. And so we actually have the father of our nation on the line tonight. I'm so excited about this. So I have a special treat from you. We're going to ask that you hold all questions for the first 10 minutes of the show. Obviously, because of this matter. But Mr. President, thank you for taking time out to be with us this evening. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I want to thank you for having me on the show.
No problem. I'm honored that you're with us today. You have handled so much pressure lately while remaining smoke-free. Are you still smoke-free, Mr. President?
You know what? That's a good question. I have been under a lot of pressure lately, especially ever since my comments about the Attorney General and saying she was beautiful. Michelle, I couldn't sleep that first night because she had a pot of hot grits sitting on the nightstand.
Al Green, Mr. President, Al Green.
So I have been smoke-free. I've been smoke-free for about an hour now. I have probably added like 15 years to my life, okay? So I feel great.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so how I'm used to be a coach, Mr. President, and so I know how brutal the media can be. And so how do you handle negativity from the media, especially when they're blurting out things that would be considered disrespectful?
First of all, that's a good question. And I'm, frankly, I'm tired of it, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
What?
What I plan on doing is taking the Middle Eastern approach. And next time somebody says something, I'm going to take off my shoe and throw it out. Okay?
So, whoa.
That's what I plan on doing. Okay?
Okay. And so do you have any kind of security or bodyguards or someone to step in when things get a little bit out of hand?
Sure. I've hired a very good friend of mine, and you probably know him from that wonderful movie, Baby Boy. His being ranked. And I have him here with me. If you want
can
to,
we speak to him? Yeah, we'd love to speak to him.
One moment. Oh, are you serious? What's up, Phil? What's going on?
Hello. We were just talking to the president, and he said that he's hired you as security.
Yeah, that's correct. I will be implementing the gangster portion of this press conference so that all the Christians can understand. I will be laying hands on fools if they decide they want to say something.
Okay.
And just to let you know, I'm not going to be as nice as the president. You know, I'm going to be throwing stilettos with 6-inch heels. You know what I mean? So you better duck.
Whoa.
Oh, boy. Okay. Can you put the president back on the show? Because we only have him for 10 minutes.
Okay. All right. I've got to go.
Thank you.
Hello?
Hello, Mr. President?
Yeah. Got bad reception. Okay.
All right. Can you hear us okay?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. I know that you play basketball, or you used to play basketball. Are you keeping up with the NBA finals? And if so, who do you think is going to win?
First of all, you know what? I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, so I'll say this, and I'm going to leave the issue alone. Somebody needs to dig in their pockets and pay the bill soon, because the Heat's going to get cut off.
Go Spurs. Okay, one last question. I heard that you liked the vacation in Martha's Vineyard during the summers, and it
That's
was
correct.
Said that you and Michelle were spotted dancing at the Reggae Fest last summer. Is this true?
That's true, and I do like to dance, but being the first African-American president, I feel obligated to make sure I learn how to Dougie and do the work.
Okay,
so that's about it.
Wow. can Michelle do the Dougie?
Yeah, that's what
Michelle can do the Dougie. She can do the Cat Daddy.
What?
The Stanky Leg. She does it all. Okay.
Wow. Well, that concludes our questions for you. We know you have to go. Those are just some of the things that I've always wanted to ask you. But we thank you for being on the show, and thank you for your time, Mr. President.
Thank you, and Sylvia, you can call me anytime. I am available. And thank you. Thank you, America, for listening. And happy Father's Day to everybody out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to comedian Mike Head, who is on the show with us today. Mike, thank you for being on the show.
No problem.
I got to give him this.
Mike, it's amazing
Absolute
how much
power.
You sound like President Obama.
Oh, really?
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I've actually heard you on other radio shows, and so I struggled to even promote this show because my show is very serious. So it was hard to, because, you know, it's a fine line between lying to people and saying we're going to have President Obama, but we didn't want to blow your cover. We wanted people to listen and actually, you know, hear how similar you sound to President Obama. Have you gotten a lot of requests to do this?
Yeah, I have. I've done maybe about like 5 shows so far. And, you know, people hear me do it on stage and they're like, oh my goodness, you sound just like this guy. So, you know, yeah, I've gotten quite a few requests.
So have you studied him? Like, how did you even know that you could impersonate Obama?
I was watching him like early, you know, during his first term when he was campaigning, and I prank called somebody just playing around, not even knowing that I sounded like him. So I was prank calling, and people were like, man, you know what? You sounded like a recording. And I really thought it was, you know, some kind of campaign recording or something like that. So I just tested it out and tried it on stage, and that's like one of people's favorite jokes of mine. It's like the first thing.
What's funny is that you actually sound like him right now. As you were telling that story, you said, and so we are going to take a quick commercial break, and we're going to let Mike transition from Obama to the real Mike Head. This is a good thing that we are now getting sponsors, so we now have commercials, everybody. So we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back with Michael Head, the comedian.
If you love sports, you're in store for a treat. Every Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern, you can tune into The Master Plan with Jerry the Master Taylor, featured at blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. The Master Plan features
a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of NBA, a little bit of baseball, a little bit of basketball, a little bit of football, a little bit of everything. And this is The Master Plan.
You can also visit fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com for archives, advertising, and other information. The Master Plan. Information, motivation, variety.
All right, you are listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. I have Michael Head here with me. Mike, I want to get into your story a little bit. Although you're a comedian, you have gone through some moments in your life that weren't so funny. You got your start playing basketball. Tell us about your journey to play basketball at not one, but two historically black colleges.
Well, it started when I graduated from high school. I wasn't going to go to college because I did not, you know, I didn't know where I was going to go. I didn't have any scholarship offers at all because I was actually riding the bench in high school. I had people recruiting me, but my coach was not playing me at all. I know Butler University was recruiting me, Pitt University, another school in North Carolina. Some other schools were sending me letters, but I wound up following a friend of mine, a childhood friend of mine, down to Alabama A&M University. I walked on the team there. That was a, you know, small Division I historically black college, and I ended up making a team, you know. So I was, to me, that was a huge step for me. And, you know, considering people were telling me you wouldn't play college ball and, you know, I wasn't good enough and all that other kind of stuff. So.
Okay, so you started out at Alabama A&M.
Yeah,
and then how did you end up? Go ahead.
I ended up leaving Alabama A&M. Because, like, at the end of my sophomore year, I was actually promised a scholarship. I was redshirted my freshman year at Alabama. And then at the end of my sophomore year, he said that, you know, he was going to give me a scholarship and all this other kind of stuff. And at the end of the year, he basically said, look, you know, I don't need you on my team anymore. And I'm like, wow, you know. And so I still wanted to play. I still had the desire to play. And I left A&M because somebody saw me, you know, I was down in the hood hooping somewhere in Cleveland, and somebody saw me and was like, man, you should come to Shaw. So I ended up packing all my stuff up, went to Shaw, and I walked on there, made the team, played, and the coach, athletic director, was like, you know what, we're going to give you some money for your senior year, you know, for your scholarship, blah, blah, blah. End of my junior year, coach gets fired. So, no scholarship. So, senior year, I am not on the team. A new coach comes in. I think it was Tracy McGrady's old high school coach. He came in, brought in a whole bunch of people. One of the players was Ronald Flip Murray. So, I ended up having to walk on my senior year. And I suffered a couple of injuries, so I didn't really play that much my senior year. I did get the opportunity to start a couple of times, and then, you know, it was over. My college career was over just like that, blink of an eye. So, and afterwards, I, you know, had a couple semi-pro, you know, exhibition games here and there. But, yeah, that was basically it.
Okay, talk to me about your feelings during your last game when you realized that this is it for basketball and that, you know, all your efforts towards playing in the NBA was not going to pan out. And that's usually most people who play basketball, like that's their dream, is to play professional basketball. But when you realize that, you know, those plans weren't going to pan out and you had to think about something else, talk to me about the feelings that you were having during that last game.
During the last game, I was just sitting there watching the time just tick off the clock. And it was kind of like watching the time tick down on, like, okay, you know, as I was watching the clock, like, it was a countdown to, like, decide what you were going to do with this, you know, second half of your life or whatever. So I'm sitting there watching it like, man, this is all I've been doing, you know, since I was in the, you know, ninth grade, so what am I going to do? And, you know, at the end of the season, it was just real sad for me. You know, I was really depressed. I was down because I guess, I felt like this was part of my identity, you know what I mean, that I was losing,
mm-hmm.
you know. So
right.
It was just a bad time for me.
Okay, so you started to transition into teaching. Talk about that transition.
After I graduated from college and kind of like got basketball a little bit out of my system, when I came home, you know, a friend of mine that I used to play basketball with helped me get a job in the Cleveland Metropolitan School District. So I started, like, working with youth groups, you know, doing, like, health education. I was tutoring because I was pretty decent in math, stuff like that. So I kind of just landed, you know, just fell into, like, education and educational youth advocacy, you know, type program. So it was nothing I aspired to do or even thought about doing. It was like, look, I need to basically take care of myself now, so I kind of need this job.
Right. So, you know, was teaching something that you started learning to like or love?
I started to like it. What I didn't like was, you know, the bad kids that I was teaching. These kids were the kids were bad, man. You know, I had a kid step to me one time in class. I mean, like, he wanted to swing on me, so I'm just like, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to do this. But it was just one of those things that, you know, I enjoy seeing, you know, the light come on when you teach somebody something and they don't know, or if they say, you know, they come up to me like, Mr. Head, I never had anybody explain something like that to me. Thank you. You're a cool teacher, and you know you. You know, when that light comes on, it's just it's very rewarding. You know, it's not like it.
Right. During this time, you started to turn to God for more direction because, you know, like you said, your identity was wrapped up in basketball, and now you're transitioning into teaching, but it wasn't something that you pursued to do. It just kind of landed in your lap. And you don't really love it, but you like it, but the kids are bad. And so, you know, you started to turn to God for more direction. Talk about this period of time when you're starting to develop a relationship with God.
That actually started when I was in, like, my last, year in college. When I started to develop that relationship, I just, you know, kind of reevaluated everything I was doing, and how I was living, and I stepped back, and it kind of like it broke me down. You know, I just remember staying up that night, you know, crying and just like praying and just pouring my heart out, and I was just like, you know, from that point on, you know. Just how I lived, how I thought, my prayer life, just everything, my relationship with God just changed. And it was kind of difficult because not everybody when you 22, 23 years old, not everybody is on that at that time. They're not trying mm-hmm. to, you know, really be fully committed, you know, to God. Not to say that I was, but, you know, people aren't vocal about it, and it's not a common conversation. So it was difficult, especially, you know, being a man, you know, and what we identify ourselves with, you know, as far as, you know, like I said, the basketball, being promiscuous and stuff. That's another thing that, you know, men identify with, and those things that we say make us a man. So
that brings me to my next question. Did you find it hard to be single and trying to live right in terms of, you know, not fornicating and, you know, sanctifying your body and keeping it holy and understanding that God lives within your temple? Was that hard to balance out for you?
Oh yeah, that was pretty hard. It was difficult, man. It was real hard. So it just was one of those things where I don't know. I just had to continue to pray about it, and sometimes you just gotta. I had to separate myself because, you know, I mean, you just got to take yourself away from certain types of environments at times, and in order to, I guess, help you in that area of your life, that walk or whatever. So.
So when you say you separated yourself from certain area, did you find yourself not dating as much just to kind of stay out of a certain position that you felt like was a stronghold for you?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, I would date sometimes, and I'd be like, no, I can't date her. You know, she's too fine, or you know, something like that. Like I just had to stay away. You know, because I was a newbie. You know, I didn't trust myself, so.
Right.
I had to stay away. Sometimes you got to stay out of certain places, you know.
Right. What's interesting to me is that in order for you to not fornicate, you would need to get married or just not have sex, right? However, you're saying to me that you just kind of stayed away sometimes from dating, or if a girl was too fine, you felt like, I can't date her, you know. So it almost seems like a catch-22 if marriage is the ultimate goal, but yet you're not even dating just to stay away from certain settings. Like, did you ever feel like you were just kind of caught in the middle?
Yeah, I did. I definitely felt like I was caught in the middle, because I knew that, you know, now I was aware and I wasn't ignorant of the fact that, okay, this is, you know, this is not what God has planned for you to live this way outside of marriage. So, but at the same time, I didn't want to use marriage as a reason to just have sex, you know, because it's, you know, it's just much more than that. So, it was difficult trying to figure all that kind of stuff out, man. So, but yeah, those were my thoughts about it.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing that, just because I think there's a lot of, especially young people, who strive to be Christians or Christ-like, but they really, I mean, they don't have a problem with giving up a whole lot of things, but it's the issue of sex and fornication that really, I think, gets people. That's one of their biggest challenges or strongholds that they deal with. And so oftentimes you feel very alone. You don't want to talk to your pastor about it, you know. And you don't want to talk to other people at church because you don't want to feel like, you know, Satan at church. So people tend to, like, keep to themselves and really go through the struggle by themselves and feel very alone and usually feeling like, this is too hard, I can't do this, I'm just going back to what's familiar to me. So I want to commend you for just kind of sharing that, because it's a very personal topic, but I think more people need to talk about it just so that we can help each other and know that there are people that you can talk to about it just to help you get through it.
Right.
Okay, so you, during this period of your life, you met a young lady and you started dating her. can you talk about that period, especially you're talking about, you were just talking about how you're trying to stay away from certain situations and there's a conflict within you. You know, you're striving to live right, but yet you're human as a man. And so talk about that period of your life.
Kind of going back to that question you said, I mean, the comment you made just a second ago, I just, and leading up to this question, because you sacrifice a lot, you know, I mean, you sacrifice the comfort of being comfortable, you know what I mean, being around somebody, satisfying your flesh, and, you know, like, you have to endure a lot of things when you make that decision, like the loneliness. But the benefits of it are, you know, so much greater because, when I was doing it, you know, I was hearing from God on a more consistent basis. You know, my prayer life was, you know, totally different. You know, I committed to things even outside of, you know, reading my Bible and, you know, spiritual things. I committed to things on a different level. You know what I mean? It strengthened you in so many areas that, you know, that I couldn't even imagine. So, but leading up to meeting her, I was a little lonely and stuff. I was hanging by myself sometimes, going places by myself. And I met her actually in a club. I was at the club by myself, you know, like, I'm just going to go here and chill. I wasn't drinking. I was just sitting there eating some pretzels at the time. And I meet her, and we started hanging out. And I told her up front, you know, we had the conversation, like, look, you know, this is not what I, as a man, I don't want this from you. You know what I mean? Because I know that, you know, sometimes women kind of go into a relationship thinking, like, you know, what does this guy want from me? And I basically explained, like, I don't want this from you. This is how I'm trying to live, making an attempt how to live. So just to be upfront and honest with her so that we both can respect each other's, you know, positions or whatever. So that's kind of how I met her, and that's how, you know, kind of what happened in the initial stages of our relationship.
Okay. So as the relationship progressed, I don't want to say
wasn't like that.
Yeah.
Just be honest. Just be honest. It wasn't like that. Okay. As it progressed, you know, stuff happened. Stuff happened. So, and, you know, ended up having my first child at 23.
Okay, so you're at this, I'll call it an intersection in the road, where you're out of school and basketball's over. You're trying to build a deeper relationship with God. You were teaching, substitute teaching, getting into teaching, and your girlfriend is pregnant. What played into your decision making in terms of which way to turn from here, from there at that moment?
Well, a few things. One of the things I did, I went back to school to get my master's, and which I really didn't know what I was doing then either. I just knew that I needed to make some more money to provide for, you know, my family or my child. So I went back to school and eventually ended up getting my master's. But one of the things that also helped me, I guess, make a decision and a fork in the road was just, you know, my dad being in my life. And, you know, I had both of my parents, you know, in my life, all of my life. So, you know, I was sitting here thinking, contemplating, like, I probably, you know, need to try to make this work, you know, between me and her, you know, the best I can. Even though we didn't start out in the right way, I think it would be beneficial to my child and, you know, to myself if I go ahead and, you know, try to make it right.
Okay. So at this time, you're trying to make the best out of the situation, and I'm skipping forward 5 years into the marriage, you ended up getting a divorce. Would you consider that one of the biggest timeout moments in your life?
Yes. It was huge. It was pretty big. Because, you know, having gone through so much, and we didn't have the proper foundation, and we kind of struggled with that in our relationship kind of, you know, from the beginning. So things weren't right all throughout. And, you know, so going through all of that, you know, the back and forth, the arguing, the ups and the downs, like when it all fell apart, you know, it was a lot of hurt, a lot of pain. It was a lot of tears and stuff. So I just really didn't know what to do. I mean, I remember sitting down having a conversation with God, like, look, I'm going to either go back to the old Mike and doing what I want to do, or I'm going to pull even closer to you and ask for your guidance in this situation, because I just really did not want to know what, I didn't know what to do, and I was so angry and so hurt, you know, when she left.
You said to me the other day, as we were preparing for this interview, that you, when you went through your divorce, you really didn't know how to pray and what to pray, and you were afraid of what would happen if you didn't pray. Can
right.
you talk a little bit about that moment where you're in this place of you don't even know what to say when you get on your knees to pray?
Yeah, I mean, you basically said it. I mean, when I was praying, I wasn't asking God for answers. I wasn't even asking why. I didn't ask what I did wrong or try to fix it or anything. I was just so mad. I was so angry. I was so hurt. I was, you know, all of the above. I was just asking God. I was just praying that I wouldn't do something stupid. That was my main prayer. Like, I was just asking God to just keep me. That was it. So I wouldn't go out and either drink or hurt somebody or go sleep with a bunch of people. So that was just my main prayer. I'm just like, Lord, just don't let me do nothing stupid. That's all I remember saying.
So talk to our listeners, especially the ones who aren't married, in hindsight, because you said that you didn't have a foundation to begin with. So in hindsight now, what are those things that needed to be, what are the things that you're talking about in terms of relationship that needed to be in place in order for you to have had a successful marriage? What do you think those things are?
I mean, going just straight out of the Bible, I mean, you have to be, I didn't know the importance of it then, but you have to be equally yoked. You just have to be. You have to agree upon, like, okay, I'm going to love God more than I love you, okay? So that's like, I guess, number one for me, you know, now, looking back and in the future, if I start dating again, I want to know that she's not going to do it just because I'm doing it. You know, I want you to have your own personal relationship, you know, Christ. So I think that needs to be established. As far as, like, boundaries and stuff like that, you know, dating is hard, you know, because you want to spend time with each other and go places. And you even want to go over to each other's house a lot of times. And, you know, you got to establish those boundaries. You got to know what you can and cannot do, or what position or environment you can or cannot be in. To be honest, I think you guys should, you know, pray together about it, pray for one another, you know, just so that you find out if this is God's best for you. You know, you might have been brought in each other's lives for a reason. Or just for a specific season. So you got to really pray that, that this is God's best for you, and not, you know, something that you know, you guys are trying to make work out. Because I was listening to something on Joyce Meyer one day, and she basically said, you know, when you do something, you know, out of God's will or whatever, you're obligated to, you know, make it work. You know, if God didn't promise it, he's not obligated to fix it. You know, no matter how hard you pray about it, you know, if he didn't promise it, he didn't have to fix it. He can do it if he wants to, but he doesn't have to. You know, and then that's kind of the situation that I was in. It kind of spoke to, you know, what I was going through.
Okay. You, on a little lighter note, you told me that on stage you tell a joke about when you thought someone broke into your house. Can you tell our listeners that joke, please?
Yeah. This is a true story, and this is a joke that I do tell on stage, because back in 2009 when she left, I was at work. Okay, so when I came home, I didn't know, like, she had packed up all of her stuff and all the kids' stuff and just left. So when I came in the house, like, I really thought somebody broke in our house and robbed us, you know, and I was, like, frantic. And I jumped on the phone and called the police. And I was like, man, this sounds crazy, but I think somebody broke in my house and robbed my wife and my kids, because all my stuff is still here. Okay. And then, so, and then I looked around and I was like, wait a minute. I was like, you know what? I'm going to call y'all back. And that's when I realized, that she had left, like, for real. So, yeah, that's what happened.
That's not funny, but
it's funny.
It's not funny, but it's funny. Do you find that some of the things that you've gone through has actually prepared you for comedy, you know, and it's a chance for you to kind of tell your story in hopes that people can relate to it and not feel like they're the only ones that experience that?
Yeah, it definitely is, because every time I go into, you know, my set about me being married and divorced, and, you know, people always come up to me after the show and say, oh my gosh, I went through that. Like, you just had me cracking up about, you know, the simplest things about marriage and stuff, the stuff that you go through within a marriage or being divorced. Because I see people's faces while I'm telling these jokes, and they're laughing so hard because they're unable to really laugh at them any other time. You know,
right.
So when they come into the club and start laughing at it, you know, I would imagine it's some kind of release for them. You know what I mean? So It definitely has.
And you as well, actually. Just
a way for you to
laugh and keep from crying sometimes, I bet. We're going to take a quick commercial break right here, and when we come back, we're going to hear from Mike Head, the father, as a parent. So we'll be right back after this commercial break.
So you think you know something about fantasy sports, huh? Well, I've got a challenge for you. Would you be willing to go head-to-head against some of the best minds in fantasy sports, like the FSP crew, The Master, Black, Jeff the Joker, and others? Well, for a limited time, you can acquire your own fantasy team. That's right, you can own a fantasy football, baseball, or basketball team and beat the host of Fantasy Sports and Politics at their own game. For more information, go to fantasysportsandpolitics.web.com. That's fantasysportsandpolitics.web.com.
All right, you are listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crawley. I'm talking here with Michael Head. We heard about Michael Head, the basketball player, the educator, the husband. Now let's talk about Mike Head, the father or the parent. And actually a single parent. Let's start with your relationship with your dad. Are you closer to your mom or to your dad?
I am closer to my mom.
Ah, mama's boy.
I'm not a mama's boy. I said I was closer to my mom. I'm not a mama's boy.
I'm calling you mama's boy. But anyways, why do you think you aren't close with your dad? Or as close as you are with your mom?
I think it was, I mean, now that I'm older and I realize why, I think it was just because of the relationship he had with his father. You know, his dad was not around until, you know, his early 20s, I want to say. You know, my dad is from South Carolina, grew up on a farm, basically had to raise himself. And he was, at an early age, taking care of his grandfather, you know, when he was like a teen or a preteen. So, and he always had to fend for himself. And his mother died when he was like 9 years old of cancer. So, you know, both of his parents were gone. So my dad is like one of the sternest guys you can ever meet. Shows no emotion. He's not scared of anything. I've never seen my dad get scared of anything. Like, so he doesn't show a lot of emotion. And when it came to his dad, even when his, you know, I remember when his dad died, he didn't show a lot of emotion. Never really talked about him much. And so I just think it was, you know, he wasn't used to really being shown that love or given love. And his example or his way of showing us love was, you know, being there for us every day. He worked all the time, made us breakfast every morning, made us dinner, cut the grass, didn't say much, but he was always there all the time.
I think from what it sounds like is your dad's love language is acts of service. So he did did deeds around the house that was his way of saying, I love you.
Right.
So in return, if you want to show your dad love, you need to do acts of service. Like he would appreciate you cutting the grass for him or, you know, cooking a meal for him because that's his language.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you think is your love language? Is acts of service your love language?
You know what? I need to explore that one a little bit more. I think
we'll talk. Go ahead.
No, I enjoy doing things for other people, but I'm a talker. So I think mine would be a little bit of, you know, acts of service and words of affirmation. Because not that I thrive off of words of affirmation, but it you know, men.
Caller from the 614, you have a question for Mike or for Sylvia?
Wait, we lost Mike.
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
Mike, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we lost you for a second.
Did I go out for a second?
You did. But I would, me interacting with you, I've known you for, I don't know how many years, quite some time now, but I would say that it is words of affirmation, but I would say your primary one is quality time, since you said you like to talk.
Yeah.
Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, it is. I enjoy spending quality time because, like I said, I am I'm a talker. So, like, if you spend any amount of quality time with me, you know, we're going to talk about some stuff. So,
okay.
That's our point.
Vic, we had a question?
One, but they're kind of shy. I was trying to get them, but that's my fault. Screening the call. Hit the wrong button.
Okay, we'll keep going.
You
know what I'm
saying? Go ahead.
We'll keep going. So, Mike, you said that your dad, he was very strict and stern, so this I'm sure a disciplinarian in the home. You know, he did a lot of acts of service, cooked meals for you. He worked hard every day. How does how you were fathered affect how you father your children?
And I say this because my dad did not do a bad job in raising me. He did, you know, he even told me most recently, you know, because he has leukemia right now. So last year was a tough year for us because we weren't, I just wasn't sure if we was going to lose him or not, you know. And like after he got out of the hospital and stuff, he kind of mentioned and set me, my brother, and my sister down and told us for the first time ever, like, you know, I hope that, you know, you guys understand I tried to do the best I knew how, you know, as a father. You know, I wanted you guys to know that I'm proud of you guys and I love you guys, which was difficult for him to say. But, you know, he told us that, and it, you know, it kind of got me all, you know, leaky around the eyes just because, you know, he never really, really said that to us before. He feels very uncomfortable at times saying, you know, I love you, you know. So I kind of made, especially I have two little girls, so I want to make sure they know, you know, that I love them. So I tell them I love them all the time. I kiss on them, I hug them constantly, and I tell them all the time how, you know, I'm proud of them. You know, I discipline them when they're wrong, and I tell them that they may have disappointed me, but I make sure that, you know, they feel me, they hear me. You know, I'm very hands-on and stuff like that, so I make sure they know, like, Daddy loves them.
Right. Let's fast forward. And you mentioned that you have two girls, one Mia, who is 5, and the other one's name is Michael, named after you, but spelled M-Y-C-H-E-L, who is 10.
Yeah.
Let's fast forward a little bit to when Michael was sick. And at this time, you had just, you know, got separated and divorced from your wife, and she got sick. Can you tell us about that timeout moment in your life?
It was a difficult moment, and it's still difficult to deal with now. But when, you know, when my ex-wife left, a few months after that, my oldest daughter started bleeding a lot, you know, when she was, you know, during her bowel movement. And, you know, I'm thinking it was just something that just happened, you know, on occasion, but it got worse. And I don't want to, you know, of course, be too graphic, but it just got to the point where it was just too much. And I'm just like, we have to take her to the hospital. So I took her to the hospital. She got a colonoscopy, and the doctor came back and told me she had Crohn's, or a form of Crohn's disease, which is an autoimmune disease for people that don't know, where the immune system kind of like attacks itself. Nobody knows why it does that, or, you know, has a reason why it happens, not even a doctor. I believe that because of the stress that, you know, Michael was under during that time, because she saw everything. She was 6 years old when we were fighting, arguing, and, you know, doing all these things. She was there to witness it. And then in a blink of an eye, you know, she was gone. She was in another house within a day. All her clothes, the beds, everything. She was just in another house. And I know that was confusing, and she didn't know how to process it. She wasn't talking about it because, you know, a kid at that age, all they want to do is play. But months after that, you know, that's when the bleeding started. And then, you know, from that point on, the doctor had said, you know, you have to put her on an anti-inflammatory because it can spread. It was centralized in the colon area, but then once it goes up into the large intestine and stuff like that, then you got to have surgery, and they got to, you know, cut your colon out and all this other kind of stuff. That's not happening. So, you know, at this point in time, even to this day, and I don't know how many years she's going to have to be on it, I have to give her medicine twice a day. And I have to give her enemas twice a week. You know, and I've been doing that for the past 4 years.
Wow. So are you and her mother on the same page in terms of, you know, giving her her medicine?
Honestly, no. You know, which is very frustrating and very, it makes me very angry. I don't know why she's, you know, not giving her the medicine that she needs. But, you know, I leave it for her to take. I've called the doctor several times and told the doctor, like, look, you know, she's not giving her her medicine. You know, I'm scared that she's going to start bleeding again. So, I mean, we're definitely not on the same page. And, you know, I just continue to pray about it. You know, there are some things that I'm doing right now that I don't want to speak of, but, you know, to prevent this from happening more in the future, but, you know, mm-hmm. that I didn't want to do, but I have to. This is my child, and, you know, I'm going to protect her at all costs.
So if you're giving her medicine twice a day, like, how does this affect her from being a kid? Like, you know, slumber parties and, you know, playing with her friends or field trips with the school? Like, does this affect her just kind of everyday living as a child?
No, not really. She continues to play, you know, just as any other child would. I know when she first found out she had the disease, when we first found out, it kind of zapped her energy, which is one of the symptoms. She was sleeping a lot. But afterwards, after, you know, we started giving her medicine consistently, you know, she never runs out of energy, even now. You know, I have to give it to her twice a day. Sometimes I may give her both of her doses in the morning or something like that. If she has, you know, has to go to a sleepover or something like that, or spend the night at my mom's or something. So it doesn't really affect her all that much. I do have to watch what she eats sometimes just to make sure she's able to, you know, digest her food well and, you know, not packing, you know, too much food down because she likes to eat like I do. So,
How have you had to adjust your social life, you know, just to be able to care for both your daughters, and especially with Michael having to give her medicine twice a day? How have you had to adjust?
Sometimes I'm tired. You know, it's a, you know, at the end of the night, and to be honest, like, I don't feel like, you know, giving her the medicine. I'm sleepy, or I'm, you know, they're worn me out. They want me to read them books and play with them, and I'm just like, all right, man, it's time for y'all to get in bed. But, you know, this is her health, you know, we're talking about, you know. And sometimes I don't want to give her the enemas because she doesn't like taking them, you know, which is natural. And I don't want to, but I know I have to. I explain to her, you know, every couple of weeks, you know, because sometimes she's like that. Like, I don't want to do this anymore, like, you know, and I explain to her what can happen if we don't do it. And she understands. It's just still, you know, we all do things that we, you know, understand, but sometimes you just don't like doing them, you know what I mean? So,
right.
But as far as, like, socially and stuff like that and dating, I don't bring anybody around my children, you know, or anything like that because I don't want that to confuse them. I don't want them to see, like, different women going in and out of my life or anything like that. So that's about it.
Speaking of which, that leads me to my next question, and then we're going to take a quick commercial break after that. What do you teach your daughters about men? I think a father-daughter relationship is very important in a girl's life. I'm a daddy's girl myself, and I'm close to my brother, and so my relationship with them really helped form my esteem, to esteem me, to let me know that I was beautiful, let me know how I should be treated by men. And so what do you teach your daughters about men?
Some things are very direct, some things are very indirect, and the stuff that I teach them about men, I do not really tolerate the pouting, you know what I mean? So I try to tell them why I let them do, because they get mad because if they fall sometimes or if they do something, they start pouting about it, I won't react to it. Because I don't want them to think that, you know, a way that, you know, as a woman, that you're going to get your way is by poking your lips out and, you know, folding your arms and walking away. You know, I don't want them to resort to that. So, and I tell them why, you know, I do that. You know, I cook for my daughters every day, you know, just like my dad did for me. You know, he made breakfast, and I make them breakfast every day. And I cook for them, you know, at night, and sometimes, you know, when they can be still in the kitchen, I try to teach them how to cook a little bit. And I just try to be an example of a man, you know, that they would want in their lives. You know what I mean? And then I have to be careful with disciplining them also. Even though I do have to, you know, discipline them sometimes, I still don't want them to say, okay, it's okay for a man to put his hands on me. You know, I want them to understand, like, this is, you know, this is my dad. I wasn't listening, so this happened in consequence. But I don't want them to say, okay, it's okay for any other man, you know, to put his hands on me. So those are the
Vic, I know you're waiting on a commercial, but this leads me to one more question while I'm thinking about it. Your daughter, Michael, is 10 years old. Mia is 5. Are they starting to get to the age where, you know, they're like, Dad, you know, they want to shut the door, they need some privacy, you know, because there comes a time in that father-daughter relationship where the separation starts to happen, where, for me, my dad was no longer, you know, the man of my life or my boyfriend, so to speak. I started to become interested in other boys, or I started to be noticed by other boys. So I drifted away from my father because I didn't want him to know that, because he wants me to, you know, always be daddy's little girl, and he doesn't want me to grow up, and he doesn't want me to face those things, and I know that. So now I'm starting to draw away, but yet still love my dad, but I'm starting to just kind of move, drift away. Are you experiencing any of that, especially with Michael at 10? Do you see any signs of that?
Not at all. First of all, both of my daughters, they're streakers, okay? They don't mind. I mean, I'm their dad. We're close. So, I mean, when I say it's time to get in the bathtub, they strip down and they, you know, they're fine with it. They're running through the house like nothing is a matter, you know. And I've been taking care of them for the past, like, you know, 4 years. We have joint custody, so they're with me a lot, and I have 60% custody. So they are just, I mean, it's like second nature to them. I mean, it's nothing. They have not shied away from it, and that's just what it is. I mean, I wash their hair and condition it, and, you know, bathe them, and, you know, so I'm there every step of the way. So they're just like, this is my dad, whatever. You know, I'm not closing the door, you know.
Right. That's beautiful. Well, just so you know, that the day is coming where they're going to start closing that door and covering up. So prepare your mind and get your shotgun ready. Vic, take us to a commercial. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
For a roundup of the week's events, interviews, and a whole lot more, tune in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern for the FSP Cruise Show, featured at blogtalkradio.com/VICHBK. Here's a sample.
We have Mr. Stephen A. Smith. Hello, Stephen A. I'm glad to, this is Jerry, your host, along with my co-host Black and Jeff on here. Glad to,
What's up, fellas? How y'all doing?
What's going on, Stephen?
Good, thanks for joining us.
Not a problem.
You can also visit fantasysportsandpolitics.webs.com for archives, advertising, and other information. The FSP Crew Show. Information, motivation, variety.
You're listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. I have Michael Head here. We've heard Mike as Barack Obama. We've heard about Mike the basketball player. We've heard about Mike the educator, Mike the father. And now we're going to transition into Mike the comedian. Mike, tell us, how did you even get into comedy?
Because I was acting stupid around the office. facilitating people, which I love to do. And one of my boys, who passed away like 2 years ago, he's the one that steered me, you know, towards comedy. So he just, you know, we were standing around talking after work. You know, he was just like, man, you were the only person that's ever made me really laugh, you know, that hard. Because he thought he was pretty funny, and he was. But it was hard to make him laugh, and he just used to laugh at me constantly, you know. And he told me, he said, Mike, you should try to, you know, go down to the Cleveland Improv and take a, you know, workshop where they teach you how to, you know, where they don't teach you how to write. They tell you to write your own material, but they make you get up every single week on a Saturday in front of, you know, like 10 people and tell jokes. And the guy critiques it. He tells you how to hold the microphone, how to, you know, enter and exit the stage and all that other kind of stuff. So that's how I got my start. I just said, you know, what else am I doing? I said, I'm not playing basketball. I'm working. You know, at this point, Michael was like maybe 3 years old, 3 or 4 years old. And I just went ahead and gave it a try, you know.
Did you do well at the workshop?
Surprisingly, I did extremely well for my first time ever being on stage. And when I walked off the stage, like, I was shaking. I was still so nervous and couldn't believe that I just went on stage and made a bunch of people laugh. And the workshop director, he came, he twisted me around, and he was like, do you know what you just did? And I was like, what did I do? I'm like, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I didn't know what happened. He was like, that was awesome. He was like, I can't believe you just did that. You need to be on the Late Show. You need to be doing. I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, I don't even know if I want to do this for real, you know. And, you know, he just was like, man, you need to keep doing this. He was like, I've never seen anybody really do that well their first time on stage. And, you know, if I would have sucked, I probably would not have picked up a microphone again. So.
It's easy to get scarred for life with trying to make people laugh. It's so surprising to me that you do stand up because I don't consider you shy, but I think you're a quiet person by choice. Do you surprise yourself sometimes because of how your personality is off stage?
No, because I think that, and we were talking about this the other day about, you know, putting on certain masks. I'm not going to give it away, but, you know, but I think my offstage persona is, you know, the cool, calm, collective guy that I present towards people because I'm, you know, I'm 6'6", I'm 215 pounds, so I'm a, you know, above average, kind of a big dude, so I'm a goofball, though, you know, constantly. I'm always laughing. I'm always laughing on the inside, and I don't want to show that side of people, you know, all the time because I'm so silly and I'm so goofy. So I really don't surprise myself because, you know, when I get on stage, that's really who I am and how I think, you know. I just try to conceal that until you get to know me. So you might just be like, man, this dude is stupid. Like, does he act this way all the time? So,
my next question is, what do you get out of comedy? Because your audience, they get to have a good time, and obviously they're laughing, but do you get anything out of it?
I definitely get a lot out of it. It is a release. I enjoy seeing people laugh. I enjoy just having a, you know, seeing people have a good time and making people smile. I mean, because everybody's hurting in some kind of way, you know. I don't care who you are. You're dealing with something. You have some past hurts or – and laughing, sometimes you laugh and you just forget about stuff. And it just turns your day around. And sometimes people have approached me after the show and said they had just lost somebody. They just lost, you know, I can't count how many times that's happened. Man, I just lost my dad. And you know what? You were so funny, you know. You know, I hope you make it, or because you just made me forget all about that, and you made me feel 10 times better. I just lost my son or my nephew, or I just got divorced, and you made me laugh about it, and I went through that. So it just it's very rewarding, kind of like teaching a little bit, you know, watching that light come on and seeing people, you know, enjoy your work.
You talked about comedy versus teaching, but how would you compare comedy, your experience in comedy versus basketball, which you spent a lot of time doing?
Basketball, I wasn't the most talented player. Of course, I had somewhat of the physical attributes. I was kind of fast and tall, but I wasn't like talented. It just didn't come to me very easy. I just worked hard and hustled harder than a lot of people around me. So, and it wasn't my gift. So it was always a struggle for me to always get to the next level. Even though I made it to the next level in a lot of ways, it was just a struggle. Comedy, making people laugh and acting a fool on stage was something that I was used to doing, you know. So it was less of a struggle for me to do. It kind of came easier and was, you know, much more of a, finesse for me when I got on stage. I didn't struggle as much. Things kind of came to me a little bit easier. And, so that whole contrast was kind of weird. You know, it was something that I didn't really seek out. Somebody just said, hey, I think this is your gift. You should try this. And I was like, okay, whatever. All right, I'm going to do it.
Do you feel like there are lessons that you can pull from all the things that you overcame trying to pursue basketball that you can apply to comedy?
Yes. Because comedy is very competitive. I mean, people don't say it. Comedians don't say it is, but everybody wants to be the funniest. You know what
the
I mean?
The main
like
act,
basketball.
The final act.
Yeah, everybody wants to be the main act. Everybody wants to be funnier than this person. Same thing with basketball. You know, everybody wants to be the man on the court. So there is that competitive spirit or nature within comedy. So it is kind of the same. I mean, with basketball, I learned how to have a work ethic and how to work hard and how to get back up, you know, from my failures. And so, like, when I'm doing comedy and stuff like that, I know how hard it takes to pursue a dream, you know, because I had one before. So I know that this is not going to be easy. You know what I mean? So I'm kind of
right.
Prepared me for that. So.
Wow. So you shared with me, before I go to that, was there ever a time when you got on stage and people weren't laughing and you questioned why you were even doing comedy?
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yes. I will never forget when I hosted and opened up for Michael Collier, who's a very funny gentleman. It was probably my worst weekend in comedy. I was getting chuckles. And yeah, I mean, it was just, and then that was it. And I'm telling my joke, I'm giving it my all, and nobody was laughing. And it was depressing. Like, I didn't even want to go back up and say the announcements, and those weren't even jokes. I didn't even want to say the announcements in between comedians, because I knew they didn't want to see me. So it was just, I walked off stage that weekend. I was like, God, why am I doing this? Why am I torturing myself? You know, I am a single dad who is very difficult for me to get out on the road and travel and do anything. Like, I'm living, you know, right outside Cleveland. Like, how am I going to go anywhere with this? And look what I'm doing. You know, so, oh, man, it was it really made me question whether I wanted to do it again.
You talked about an experience that you had where, you know, there were there's two different clubs in Cleveland. There's, you know, like a mixed club and there's a more urban club. Can you talk about that experience and just trying to, the difference between the two?
Yeah, there's two different main clubs in Cleveland. One of them is, you know, predominantly, you know, one persuasion, and the other one is a little more urban. Occasionally, one of the clubs will have mixed audiences where you have, you know, a good mix of people, demographic as far as like black and white and, you know, your economic status and stuff like that. And one of them, just on any given night, is just this hood, just all hood, gold teeth, you know, just everything that you can imagine in there. And it's like when I do the mixed clubs, you know, I do pretty well, you know what I mean, because I'm not a hood guy. You know, I grew up, you know, in a suburb of Cleveland. My people moved out of the hood, you know, when I was born. So, and we moved out to a suburb of Cleveland. And so I kind of did real well with those crowds. And then when I did the urban crowd, you know, which was a draw for the Michael Collier show, it was terrible. I just did a horrible job. And it just made me. I'm a black man, you know. I'm performing in front of, you know, an urban crowd, which was, you know, predominantly African American, you know. So I'm just like, you know what? I can't even make my own people laugh, you know. So I'm like, these people looking at me like I'm crazy, you know. So and I said, I was like, man, this is never. I'm like, this ain't happening no more. This is not happening to me anymore. I'm not going to go out like this. So, yeah, and it didn't.
So what did you do to kind of help whenever you were in that type of setting? You said to yourself, this is not going to happen to me again, but did you make a change in your, you know, material?
Yeah, I mean, I told my jokes, told the same jokes, but I told them a little bit differently. I had to add some things to it. I had to tweak some things. I went back and rewrote a lot of my stuff. You know, the same stuff that didn't work, I had to go back and tweak it. And I had to, you know, I had to carry myself in a different kind. Not just totally change who I was, you know, but I had to relax. I relaxed. I tweaked some stuff, and it just came out totally different. It came across to the crowd in a different kind of way. And I did, you know, the Bruce show. I opened up for him most recently. Same kind of crowd, urban, but, I mean, totally different reaction, night and day. You know, I'm taking pictures after the show. They're like, oh, my God, you were funny. You were hilarious. And I'm just like, cool, you know. Yeah, because I said I did not want to go through that again, man. That was bad.
There are a lot of comedians who have foul mouths on stage, and because of it, I think people think they're funny. Do you think you would be funnier if you dropped a few F-bombs and cursed a little bit more? Did you ever kind of struggle with that? Because just in talking with you, this everyday conversation, you're not a huge curser. You know, you don't curse a lot. So is that something that you struggle with as a comedian?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely struggle with it because, you know, some people even tell me, like, man, you might have to cuss at this show or you might have to drop a couple of these or, you know, and I didn't want to have to resort to that because, you know, I think it's funny. When I see other comedians curse, I laugh. I'm not even going to lie. Like Eddie Murphy and Jamie Foxx and, you know, all these other great comedians and Dave Chappelle, I think they are hilarious. And do they curse a lot? Yes. But, you know, I've got an opportunity to work with Sinbad quite a few times, who doesn't cuss at all, or comedians that are generally clean, that really don't use that type of foul language, where they get their point across and they're still funny. So, yeah, I've definitely struggled with it because I don't want that to be, you know, my label. You know, he's a foul mouth comedian or he's vulgar or anything like that. So
in wrapping up the show, are you happy now where you are? Do you feel do you feel like you found your place in comedy?
Yeah, I think I found my place. I haven't found my voice yet. I think I found my place, but I'm in the process of kind of like finding my own voice. When I say that, you know, prime example, hottest comedian on the planet right now is Kevin Hart, who has found his voice. He's a storyteller. He just grabs your attention with these crazy off the wall stories. And everybody can't tell stories like that. Everybody can't be a punchline joke, you know, teller. So I'm in a place of kind of like finding about who I am on stage. And, I'm happy with that. I'm kind of coming into my own a little bit. I'm not by far there yet, but I'm in a good place right now in comedy.
Okay. So do you ever think you'll get married again? You've been divorced for about 2 years now. Do you still believe in love, and do you think you'll ever get married again?
My divorce was final 2010, so it's officially been, you know, like almost 3 years now. So, I think I'll get married again because I don't like being by myself. Even though I choose to be, and like I said, the benefits of it are wonderful. You grow closer to Christ. You sacrifice a lot of things, you know, in doing that, you know, and choosing to live like that. I think the love will be all the more sweeter, you know, once I do get married, especially if I run into that person who is, you know, trying to lead a similar life. And, you know, I'm like a helpless, like, romantic type dude, you know. It's not a lot of rap CDs in my collection. I'm an R&B kind of guy, Dane Ingram, Barry White. You know, just
Frankie.
You know, Frankie. You know, that kind of stuff, man. So that's me. So, but yeah, I think I'll get married one day. But I just gotta, going through something that I went through like that, it kind of leaves you scarred. So just to be honest, you know, it's not a myth or anything, or it's very true for men to just have like. Just be hurt for a long time and have insecurities and just doubt themselves and your self-esteem and confidence can take a blow when stuff like that happens. So that's what has happened to me, and I'm still not over all of it. I've worked through some of it, but I ain't over all of it. So.
All right. What's next for Mike Head?
What's next and exciting for me, you know, the most current thing is I will continue being a father, which I'm most excited about. And one thing I said was I will give up comedy and acting if it means sacrificing a relationship with my daughter. You know what I mean? So if I can't take them with me or they can't be with me a lot, I would give it up. But the most exciting thing right now is recently. Me still living here in Cleveland, which is a blessing because I'm able to kind of go out, do my thing, and come back. I just recently auditioned for Comic View. Comic View is coming back to BET. I got a call just out of the clear blue sky and said, hey, we want to feature you on Comic View, but you got to audition. So I went to Houston and did that and did, pretty good. I did extremely well, actually, and hopefully, but these are national auditions, so I don't know what they're looking for, but, you know, hopefully they give me a call back. Then, actually, this week, I will be going to Miami to perform at the American Black Film Festival, 17th annual American Black Film Festival. I'll be competing against four other comics from across the country. This is the first comedy competition that they've had. Because I performed there in the semifinals in LA in Los Angeles a couple months ago, and here I am getting ready to go to the finals. And it's it's big for me. It's a blessing for me because, you know, I was telling you this a few days ago when my ex-wife left, I felt like, okay, this is an opportunity for me to pursue, you know, this dream, I guess, that God gave me. And I tried to go to the American Black Film Festival 3 or 4 years ago. But, you know, my money, I didn't have any money. I was living in a one-bedroom apartment with my daughters, and I tried to save the money to go, and I couldn't. And so fast forward 4 years later, I get on the website, just, of course, not by happenstance, but I haven't been on the website in years. I get on there and find out that they got their first comedy competition. I submit a film and got picked out of, like, 300 people. And so I made it to the finals, and now I get to go to the American Black Film Festival for absolutely free. They're paying for everything, and to me, that
what a blessing.
Just blew my mind. It just blew my mind. Yeah. So that just, you know.
It's almost like you've come full circle.
You said what now?
It's almost as if you've come full circle.
Yeah, it came full circle. I mean, and then every time I think about it, you know, it almost drops me to my knees just because of how it happened and the way that it's happening. So
you can appreciate it so much more. Mike, I want to thank you for being on the show, and thank you for being so transparent with us tonight and sharing your story. I always say it's important to share your story because you never know when someone else may be going through a similar thing who may not be as strong as you. And sometimes it just helps to know that you're not the only one going through it. So thank you for being a good father to your daughters and adding to the father blueprint. And I think as more men speak about it, other young men will see, like, it's cool to be a good dad, you know, and it's not cool to not create the relationship that you didn't have with your father. And I think the more men talk about it and embrace it, the more you show younger men the way in that area. So I want to commend you for that, and also for staying true to yourself as you pursue your dreams within comedy and as you seek to find your own voice. You know, there are a lot of people who make a career decision to be a certain way, but that's not who they are. So I commend you for staying true to who you are, because it's not going to work with you trying to be an imitation of someone else. So, you know, you could be the best you that you can be. So please tell our listeners how they can follow you on Twitter, on Facebook.
Yeah, you can look me up, Comedian Mike Head on Facebook. Friend me, talk to me, I'll talk back to you. You can look me up on Twitter, @ Mike Head Comedy. I got like 20 followers, so I need some more people following me.
I'm one of them.
right. And you can go to my website. It's kind of like a blog, just where you can subscribe to my blog, and it'll send you an email update. It's just some of the things that's going on in my comedy career, like if I'm, you know, in your city, or if I'm hosting a show somewhere, or, you know, things like the American Black Film Festival. The site is MikeHeadComic.wordpress. So it's just MikeHeadComic.wordpress.com. Go on there, subscribe, you know, click on my Facebook tab, Twitter tab. I may have like one or two YouTube videos up, so that's it.
Yes, he has an Obama link up where you can hear more of him impersonating Obama. But my time, good people. I want to remind you to join me for the live Twitter chat with Monarch Magazine, and you can follow @ Monarch Magazine or S. Crowley Milbury. That's my Twitter account. And also tune in next week to hear a dynamic speaker and my very own brother, Dr. Rex Crowley. He has a tremendous testimony where he beat cancer 3 times, bone marrow transplant, and open heart surgery. So you don't want to miss his incredible story. And you're listening to Time Out with Sylvia Crowley. Take a time out.
Tell me what you want, tell me what you see, where you want to go, what you want to be. If you have a dream, you can make it there with a lot of work and a lot of
take your time, gotta be precise, gotta have a plan, double check it twice, wait, hold up, slow down, devil need advice, someone's gone before, maybe talk to them, then after you do, go and talk to him, greatest gonna come, maybe not tonight, take your time today, teach you something right.
Got a lot of friends, made a lot of ends, Twitter, you the trend, him a Bentley Benz, but you moving kinda fast, keep sweats, you gotta make it last, live every day like it's your last, but don't forget to have a blast.